Yeah, I'm recording.
Now recording. Craig's still here. He hasn't been, he hasn't been restrained by WotC yet. We haven't got any cease and desist with him.
Technically, so. I haven't published any material yet with him. Fuck. No, I have.
Oh, shit, you did, didn't you?
Shit. He is owned by WotC now.
No.
Damn it.
No, he is not. Because
yes, he is.
No, because remember, they backtracked.
They may have backtracked the OGL and shit, but, however, and this is probably something we'll talk about a little bit more in detail tonight. I publish all my materials on DM's Guild, okay?
That's fair, yeah.
And whenever you publish in DM's Guild, they maintain ownership of that item that you publish on there. And the Tube of Refurbishment is on the DM's Guild right now for free. Just go to dmsguild.com, search for Tube of Refurbishment. You'll get the free adventure that I put out last year. In the adventure,
how is his name spelled?
The right way.
CR'AIG?
Yes.
Okay. Then was he also he was a full orc barbarian. Was he that?
He didn't have a stat block. Everything about him was described. He was described as being the mascot of the Grumpy Dungeon Master channel in two places.
That's
so
you wrote us into it. That means they own us.
Oh shit, they do. Oh
damn
my god.
Damn you, WotC. Damn you to hell.
And so there's a lot with the OGL, and I know we've been talking a lot about that. It is still the main topic on everybody's mind. So it does need to be brought up again, because WotC
has...
And again,
and over until they fucking get the message.
Yeah. WotC put a pin in it recently, 2 days ago. So it's essentially Friday of last week when you're hearing this on Tuesday. And stated that they heard the outcry from the public and have stopped any plans to publish an OGL at this time, and that they are going to move forward with publishing an OGL in the future to better explain new technologies and things, and also to help protect people from being discriminated.
yeah,
which I said is not in the current OGL, which it absolutely
is. There were so many lies in their backtracking.
Their backtracking was full of shit.
The fact that they called it a draft that was released on multiple occasions in their backtrack, and I'm going to continue to refer to it as a backtrack because that's what the fuck it was.
Yeah.
But it was never a draft. You don't send out a draft with an NDA with contracts to sign. That is not a draft.
Right. And what I found fascinating about that is just the snarky tone that they took with the whole thing. I feel like this thing was not written by the PR team or the marketing team. I feel this was written almost like by the VP secretary or someone up higher than the normal D&D staff or the normal WotC staff, because the statement at the end, and I'll read the whole paragraph here. For those of you who haven't read it, basically, it says a couple of last thoughts. First, we won't be able to release a new OGL today because we need to make sure we get it right, but it is coming. Second, you're going to hear the people say that they won and we lost because making your voices heard forced us to change our plans. Those people will only be half right. They won, and so did we. Bullshit.
No.
No one's winning in this situation. There is going to be a new OGL. There was a new OGL. They called it the GSL when 4th edition came out. No one liked it. No one used it. And on top of a number of other reasons, mostly game-related with the system, 4th edition was a big flop. And it hurt the brand. And it took a long time for things to recover. And it's going to happen again with D&D D and Done. One D&D, sixth edition, whatever
it is currently D and Done.
D and Done. And what's surprising about it is that they tried to basically sneak this in instead of a new gaming license because they wanted to leave the OGL 1.0A behind with Third, and because Paizo had already taken a big chunk of that and whatnot. Mm-hmm. It was really a surprise move and a desperation move that they continue using the OGL for the 5th edition. So when they come out with what's supposedly now the rumor is a 2.0, when D&D Dunn comes out, and it's going to basically restructure the whole thing. And people are going to get upset about it and for a number of different reasons. People are going to say, oh, you're going to steal our IP. You're going to take all of our money, this, that, and the other thing. And all of that really just doesn't matter. Because if they build a platform, okay, like DM's Guild, and they take 50% instead of 20, 25%, it's still going to be controlled by them. They're still going to have ownership of them. WotC owns everything that I've made for on DM's Guild right now. I am fine with that because that is the platform that lets me put my content out there that people will actually see. And there's a little bit of marketing that comes with it as well, too. If that's the way of the world, that's the way of the world. But you can't.
It's not the way of the world, though. Like that is their platform. Everyone understands that,
right?
Like you are affected. Like when you sign up to put things on the DM's Guild, you're having to sign that contract. Nobody's going to complain about that. But if I want to go out and get a book printed, then they shouldn't have much say over that. That's what that OGL one was for.
Yes and no. I mean, they were trying to get a clamp on those people like Paizo and Cobalt Press and MCDM and all of them. But that's a legal battle that has to be done in court. There's actually a Legal Eagle. Do you know who Legal Eagle is?
I've heard you talk about him.
Okay. Legal Eagle is a guy that does all these cool lawyer videos on YouTube. And he took a little break from his normal lawyering stuff about like Congress and Supreme Court and these big, heavy hitting, life changing discussion topics, and brought down and covered the Dungeons and Dragons OGL.
Apparently, it got that big.
It got that big. Well, that and also, I guess, at the end of the video, there's another lawyer who basically does mostly gaming related lawsuits and stuff like that. He suffered a stroke at the end of last year. So he kind of did this for him and promoted his GoFundMe so people could, help him out as well, too. So there's a bit of two reasons why he did it. But he was stating, is like, you can't do half the stuff people were afraid of. Like, you can't trademark or copyright a system of rules. Okay.
Yep.
And the OGL really wasn't needed in the first place because you can't copyright a set of rules. So like Monopoly was the example that he used. You could release a game that has the same exact Monopoly rules in essence, as long as you change the verbiage of the rules, but still have the same game. Okay. And you do not use any of the art assets, essentially, of the game. You can make your own Monopoly game.
That's why there's 8 billion different versions of Monopoly out there.
That's actually because they lost a trademark to the word Monopoly in Europe because they didn't renew it.
I'm just saying, but you could have literally just remade Monopoly and call it something else.
Right. So, I mean, like they said, the player's handbook, you could rewrite the player's handbook in completely different verbiage, but as long as it's completely different, they can't do anything about it. It's still going to be 5th edition. That's why I kind of foresee that if 5th edition is as popular as it is, people are just going to keep making 5th edition content and just F off on any OGL things. And like, what are you going to do about it? And then you posted a video of a mock table thing, which you can find on our Discord.
It's called Man Shorts. If anybody is not familiar with it, they've been doing videos for several years now.
Where the only thing WotC can really do in all its legal gray area is just tie you up in litigation until you run out of money or just give up. Which, given the rumors that they're making something like $500 million a year off of D&D, they can. So
pretty easily.
There's a lot of craziness. I think for me, what best sums everything up is the article that Penny Arcade put out. The last paragraph of what Tycho wrote kind of sums up my feelings about the whole thing. I'm gonna you always go to Penny Arcade, penny-arcade.com, and read the whole thing and the funny comic that goes with it. But he says at the end of his article that D&D isn't really a brand. It's a culture, which is a million times better than a brand. And it's not like that doesn't have direct implications for the bottom line. D&D is on its most successful iteration ever, precisely because it is a universal touchstone. I've heard from Wizards that streaming and podcasts are to thank for that. I can't really make heads or tails of your apology, referring to the one that they put out about the OGL 2 days ago. But let me say this. You've entered treacherous waters entirely on your own volition. Just turn around and walk out. And that's kind of what it is. Like, no matter what happens, D&D is always going to be around at the end of the day. They can come out with an even more draconian OGL when D&D Done comes out. And it will die the second it gets released. No one's going to care. They'll go to Pathfinder. They'll go elsewhere. They'll just play their own 5th edition games continuing. I was reading Advanced 5e today, and by God, it was amazing.
I know, so, right?
So it doesn't matter what WotC does with D&D Done. You've already shot yourself in your foot. Even if you do, as Tycho says, just literally turn around and back out, I don't think it's going to survive. I think they've ruined too much of the goodwill. The internet culture of... I'm going to say the type of people that get pulled to tabletop RPGs are on the internet a lot. They're very powerful keyboard warriors. Yep. They don't forget easily, and you've pissed them off.
Even the old bastards who play first and second edition, like we all spend a lot of time online.
They're not going to forget in 4 or 5 months and turn around and just walk away. So WotC needs to be very careful. They can continue going down this path and trying to push out D&D Done. They're not going to get good feedback anymore. I don't think people are going to care.
No.
They've lost a massive amount of subscriptions to D&D Beyond.
Yeah, we don't know.
Mine being one of them, technically.
We don't know the exact amount, obviously, and we probably never will. But it forced them to halt what they were doing and turn around on a fucking dime. And massive companies like that don't do that unless it's substantial.
This is just me guessing, okay? D&D Beyond is a pretty big website, okay? They're probably built in the cloud. They probably have scalability built in, like any normal website should. So for their cancellation system to go down and for the cancellation dragon to show up, which is the official name for him now.
Okay.
And to 404 out as much as it did, there had been hundreds of thousands of calls hitting that website.
Yeah.
Okay. So even if those hundreds of thousands of people who were unintentionally doxing the website, okay, if half of those resigned, that's, 100,000 people there. So it was substantial enough to get them to turn around, and that's a good thing. And they have to be very careful.
So just as a rough estimate, and this is obviously off the top of my head, if those subscriptions were $10 a month at 100,000 people, that's, what is that, $1 million? $1 million a month? That's $1 million a month that they're out.
Yep.
And those numbers could be far more substantial than that.
Yeah, it definitely is. It definitely was a big blow to them. And I think they kind of realized how bad of a spot they were in. Coming off of Magic 30, coming off of just a general sense that they don't care about the people and you're just between them and the money, they just have to be very careful.
Yeah, like everybody who listens to the podcast knows, I was already leaving D&D. Like, I've been looking for something else for 2 years now, and I had already made the decision to move to Pathfinder even before this happened. And that is specifically because of the quality of what they've released for 2 years.
I find that interesting too. And I was part of all this thing that kind of came out. There was a guy named Matt Coville who was interviewed a lot. Matt Coville is he's been in the tabletop role playing scene for a long time.
Yeah.
And one of his earliest publications was in the D20 system under the OGL. He helped write the Critical Role Vox Machina thing. He actually was a part of Wizards of the Coast for a little bit when his company got bought out by them. He was a part of Strongholds and Followers, Kingdoms and Warfares. Yeah, and
it's the Strongholds and Followers is where I recognized the name from.
So he's basically the co-founder of MCDM Productions. And listening to him talk about WotC and everything going on, it's just been fascinating. I've been following his stuff now ever since that. I wish I would have known about him earlier, but I'm still myself just kind of getting into who's who in the tabletop creative scene. There's a video, I put this on the Discord, where he was talking about this OGL coming down on people back in August and how it was the worst idea for them to do that because 5th edition was super popular and it was going to ruin everything for them. But another thing that he mentioned and talked about for a little bit was the OGL, the reason why it made WotC kind of come back from the brink of nothingness was because they realized, WotC is, realized that writing adventures doesn't bring them any money. Writing source books does. Okay.
I don't know that they've realized that because they write 3 adventure books a year and one source book a year.
So, well, every one of those adventure books has one chapter of extra things in it.
That's not a source book under any means.
No, it's not. That's part of the problem that they're running into is that they've kind of like lost track of, hey, we're not publishing the lore books anymore. We're not publishing these cool source books anymore. We're kind of just like spreading it out like a bad custard over a bunch of different foods and just hoping you really enjoy it. And like they kind of force people, like if you want to play a Haragon, you got to buy a Witchlight. The DM has to buy it for the adventure. The players have to buy it for the rules. And yeah, it's going to be bad. And that's why they've been shifting over to D&D Beyond. And right now, they haven't focused and doubled down on this yet, but I foresee them doing this, where you can buy certain sections of the book off of D&D Beyond.
I believe they would do that, yeah.
Well, they've had it ever since I started using D&D Beyond. Like, I bought the stat block for, what's his name? The Lich in Tomb of Annihilation.
Oh, Acerak.
Acerak, yeah. I bought the stat block for Acerak because I didn't need any other stat block in the book. I had all the ones I needed because I was running from the book, but I needed Acerak because I needed his stat block for the final encounter. And there's something that I can use.
Let me throw this out.
It costs $3, by the way.
Oh, yeah, that's cheap, but it's still $3 for a stat. Right. That, I mean, come on. So, and this is just kind of shit on WotC and, you know, kind of prop up Paizo, because Paizo is an actual gaming company, whereas WotC was a gaming company that got bought up by Hasbro, which is a toy company that's trying to move online. They are not a gaming company by any means. So yeah, I started looking
at who's currently running it.
Right. I started looking at some comparisons of what we have with the Pathfinder second edition stuff when compared to what WotC has been releasing. So Pathfinder 2nd edition came out August of 2019. There are, I think it was 32 books that have already come out.
Mm-hmm.
That's adventures. That's, and there's like 12 books just for one setting alone, not adventure books, just lore books.
Yeah.
For Lost Omens. Then there's about 12 rule books, give or take, and then roughly 10 or so of the adventure books. And that's since 2019.
Yeah.
So 2019 to now 4 books a year for WotC, like the 16 books. 5 years. So 20 books compared to 30 something for the Pathfinder. Then you're talking about D&D Beyond, where you have to purchase a stat block. So our buddy Bruce, he messaged me like half an hour before the podcast and got me to watch a TikTok that he had sent me a couple days ago. And I'm glad he did, because it pointed out this website called the Archives of Nethys, which I was not familiar with. The Archives of Nethys is approved by Paizo, so they know about it. It's I think it's fan-run, fan-made, but they are perfectly okay with everything that's on that site. Now, that's not to say later down the road they won't, you know, pull the plug on it. But currently, it has all of Pathfinder 1st Edition, all of Pathfinder 2nd Edition, and all of Starfinder. It has all your stat blocks, it has all your classes, all your equipment, your races, rules, everything on those websites, or that website. And they don't charge you anything for this. You know, that's what WotC should be doing.
Giving people no money in
access.
That.
I know there's no money in that, but it gives access to stuff. It proves that you're not a shit company and people will stick with you.
Well, the issue becomes is that Paizo is not making anywhere near the amount of money that D&D is currently making.
I bet they are now.
Well, now that you can basically use code, what was it, OpenOGL on their site right now and get all the rule books for 25% off and a free adventure. Yeah.
You're having to buy them. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You're talking about the Pathfinder. Yeah. Barring that, hell, I've dropped in the last 2 months, I don't know, $100 or so on Pathfinder stuff.
Yeah. No, like I said, like, They have a team that's dedicated to building for putting out content, whereas WotC has a team that's kind of a much smaller team that's contracted out to basically write content here and there, and they do a good job at it, but it's being killed in the editing, you know. Yeah. And that's the sad kind of truth of it.
It really is, yeah. Like, you know, I complain a lot about the content that WotC puts out, but it is not the writers I complain about. I will never complain about them because they're doing their best under the hard restrictions that they are given.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, I really kind of feel for the entire group team that's there kind of writing things and just trying to put things together and kind of hold the fort. And I wish D&D would be successful. I just don't feel like it's going to be. And I don't care anymore about the next edition.
I didn't particularly care about the next edition anyway. I mean, we do a podcast about it, so we cover, you know, things like that on here. And I'm sure when they start releasing more content, we'll still cover it because that's what we do. But I don't care about 6th edition. I barely cared about 5th edition at this point. Advanced 5e, I like. I hope they keep pushing it along because they actually are releasing a lot of good content.
Yeah. So what was your funniest meme that you saw out of this whole debacle?
I've seen a lot of really, really good ones. My favorite one, I think, is the one I shared with you guys the other day. And it's, let me pull it up here.
I pull up my favorite one so far has been definitely the one from the Penny Arcade guys where Gabe and Tycho were sitting on the couch and they're kind of like discussing the OGL and they're like, man, I really wish we could make a comment about it. But you know what they say? Don't bite the hand that feeds you. And Tycho kind of looks at Gabe and goes, they don't pay us, nor do they feed us. And Gabe's like, what are you talking about? I was like, yeah, We've already been paid for the book and AQ Inc. We don't get paid to put that stuff on. We just do it for fun. And he's like, oh, really? And then the next panel is him at the D&D corporate office grabbing the wizard employee saying, hands back on the menu. And he's like trying to bite off the guy's hand. I found it quite funny. I got a chuckle out of it.
That's a good one. The one I saw, it's got a balloon or a bubble or something that says locking down intellectual property by retroactively changing the OGL. And it has some dude that says WotC next to him. And then right behind him, you see this big pink thing start wrapping its arms around WotC, and it's called the Tolkien Estate.
Yeah. Because that was actually a big thing that was going to happen is like if you were going to force creators immediately to sign over the IP and intellectual property once you make over $750,000, and the Lord of the Rings 5e supplement is coming out in a couple months.
Yeah.
You really want to fight with them over who owns Lord of the Rings?
Well, barring that, literally all of Dungeons & Dragons is based off of Lord of the Rings.
I mean, That's fair, but it would be hard to argue that in court. Enough of it has changed.
Yeah, I don't expect that. Look, this is all kind of a joke. None of that's likely to go to court.
And then on top of that, I don't even think you could fight the Tolkien estate, because half the stuff that Tolkien used were just old folklore things that he grew up with as a kid. What, Scandinavian folklore stuff? No, that's Witcher.
Well,
whatever.
I mean, a lot of it's just European folklore. A lot of it is. Coming from various places.
I mean, you can't use the Elven language because that guy was weird. But
well, the Elven language actually probably is actually owned by the Tolkien estate.
Yeah,
because he created it. He wrote it. I don't know. Yeah, I know the Tolkien estate. They're pretty finicky about what they let other companies use.
I did see something about the Knights of the Old Republic using the OGL. And that was actually a fake piece of news one guy put out during the midst of all this as a joke, and people thought it was real. I thought it was real, and it just kind of took off and went crazy from there. But he in his video, I can't remember who it was, he specifically said, I did that by accident, and that's not real. Don't take their word for it.
I'm trying to remember when that game came out.
It was around third edition, but it used its own system.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The original one came out in 2003. The OGL came out before that. So,
yeah.
But either way, yeah, that's still funny. Yeah. That was my favorite meme, but there are just so many of them. Like, I avoid Reddit kind of like the plague, but I found myself scrolling through the Reddit D&D memes that day.
Well, It's a weird, shitty circumstance people put in. I've seen a lot of DMs who are like, I'm not playing games anymore. I'm done.
Well, that's
this has killed it for me.
Yeah, don't do
and
that.
It's really sad. Like I'll be honest. Like I felt the same way. Like I was kind of doing my game and kind of putting together the stuff. And there's that little voice in the back of my head's like, you shouldn't be doing this because WotC hates you. Why would you want to put anything out for them? So,
I mean, everything that's being released, because there are some people on the inside that are talking. And from what I've continuously been hearing, it really does seem as if the WotC higher-ups don't like the fans at all. No. It's the equivalent of the whole Kathleen Kennedy going off about the second Star Wars movie. She hated the fans. If you hate your fans, if you hate the people who are giving you money, you should probably sell the property and just be done with it. Get rid of it.
Yeah.
But anyway,
it's just a crappy place to be in. Like, the purpose of this podcast is not only to talk about tabletop RPG news, but like to also talk about how to be a better DM. And it's discouraging because like you can't.
You
hate it when people just are doing things because they just want money from you, and they see that you're just there for, just rip out your money out of your wallet. And it makes me feel shitty and makes me not want to write any content for WotC. But it's still a dream job. I'd love to do it. I would still do it in a heartbeat. Knowing my luck, I'd probably get the chance when 6th edition hits and no one plays 6th edition, so no one will ever read my stuff,
Seems likely, knowing, yeah. Yeah,
that. Knowing my luck.
That'd be part of the course, yeah.
I'd still be happy and proud of my work.
Sure.
There's still a lot of legal area. I mean, things are changing. The world is very different. Virtual tabletop is very prominent, and there's a lot of money to be made out there. Matt Colville was talking about how WotC actually was making 4th edition on the back of becoming a VTT. And I mentioned how there was a VTT for them, like they were ahead of the schedule. Well, he actually talked about the full history of it. They actually hired a bunch of Microsoft engineers to develop the VTT, and they were almost done with it, but there just wasn't a market for it. Everyone hated 4th edition. Everyone hated the GSL. So they kind of scrapped the plans. And I saw what that VTT became in the future was just an over-modernized piece of crap. Right. And now they have another team of even bigger developers developing another VTT to be put behind D&D Beyond. That's where they're going to push everybody. So they definitely foresee people are going to be playing games online more than around the table in the future.
I think there's a market for both. There will always be a market for both.
Yeah,
some people really like to do it online. I will say, if I was playing online, I could play 5 games a week if I really wanted to. There's no way to do that in person. That being said, I've played online and I play in person, and I personally have a much better time in person. But for everybody else, it is whatever it is. It's whatever they enjoy. If you want to do it online, do it online. If you want to go in person, do it in person. If you want to play by mail, that used to be a thing. You could probably
do it online.
I did say do it online. It's cybering. Oh God, we're back in the 90s.
So I don't know. I'm just
it is disheartening when you find out that the company that is making the stuff you love is trash. It doesn't mean to stop playing the game. It doesn't mean you have to stop creating. And fortunately, this is a market where there is a massive amount of other games. So I don't think that D&D 5th edition is the greatest system ever. It absolutely is not. It is a wonderful system for players. It is a wonderful system for game masters because it's simple. It is not wonderful for players. Never has been. It's very boring and generic for players. That being said, there are lots of other systems out there for DMs that are easily runnable. There are lots of other systems out there for players that are easily playable. Just find the one that suits you the best. For me, it's going to currently be Pathfinder, at least.
So I was reading the Advanced 5e stuff because I was looking for more devils and fiends to put in my my Waterdeep game.
Yeah.
And I busted open the mythological monsters and mythical monsters and something else with an M. And I was surprised to see what was in the book. Okay.
Yeah.
So when you think mythical monsters, what do you think?
You mean Monsters Menagerie?
No, mythical monsters. Hold on. Let me find the real.
Is that another book?
Yeah. Hold on.
Shit. How do I not have that one?
Huh. Okay. The book name is Level Up Mythical Figures and Maleficent Monsters.
I have not seen this.
It's an 5th edition book. So, what do you think kind of monsters are in this book?
What was it called again?
Mythical Figures and Maleficent Monsters.
Maleficent Monsters. Is it Disney Monsters?
No.
I don't know.
Okay. So, and this is going to be amazing. All right. The book basically contains stat blocks for every current public domain monster that you could have, like Frankenstein, Dracula, Cthulhu.
Mythical figures. Okay.
Okay, so they're all in there, but then it's got actual people who existed, like Billy the Kid, Blackbeard, George Washington, Samu Khan, Sinbad, Santa Claus.
Sinbad's not real.
Nikola Tesla. So it just floored me. It just freaking floored me looking at these.
You know what happened? The four guys who worked there, and I'm just throwing out a number, I don't know how many worked there, but the four guys who worked there got drunk one night, sitting around a campfire, and just started spouting off ideas of whose stats they could come up with. And then they actually made it happen.
So they got Cleopatra, Conan the Barbarian, Cthulhu, the Loch Ness Monster, Lancelot, Joan of Arc, the Jersey Devil, Jekyll and Hyde, Odysseus, Paul Bunyan, Babe the Blue Ox, Miyamoto, Musashi.
That's fantastic.
Morgan Le Fay. Titania. Yeah,
I might have to get a copy of this book. I don't know how this one had gotten by me.
And then the best part is, on top of all that, they brought the Warlord class back for the fighter in the same book.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought they already had that. And I think that was in the standard Advanced 5e, actually.
No. This is brand new thing from the Warlord Fighter archetype with all the Warlord tactics and everything involved. And I was like, God damn. I wish I was playing this.
I do love the Warlord. I've always been a fan of that as a class.
So I was just floored by this. They had no demons other than Satan. Satan's in here, by the way.
Yeah, well,
I'm not going to use Satan.
You already do. Like, what do you think Asmodeus is? And Mephistopheles and Beelzebub. They're all versions of Satan. Versions of Satan!
So that was kind of crazy, and I found it funny.
That's cool. Yeah, maybe they might have added it in one of their monthly things. That might have been where I'd seen the Warlord. To be fair, I could be completely confusing it with something else that I'd seen. I've been looking at a lot of stuff lately. So
yeah. So that was neat, and I have like the Monster Manual, and the Monster Manual just has all the same monsters, it seems, as the D&D Monster Manual. Although it does have some better stats and like
it has more stuff. There's a lot more lore. There's a lot more random tables to find out information about them. We talked about it a while back.
I really want to get that one demon book that I found a little while ago, but I can't find it anymore, and it's not in the store, so I probably have to find it online.
Yeah, because I remember asking what the name of that thing was, and you told me. I was like, man, that's really awesome, and even I've forgotten all about it.
Yeah. I didn't forget about it. I was like, I'll buy it after Christmas if my wife doesn't buy it for me. And then she didn't buy it for me for Christmas, and I went back to buy it, and it was just gone. I was like, nah.
Check eBay. Might be on there for $200. Who knows?
Maybe.
All right. So with all the hubbub about, you know, the OGL thing going on, I have seen just an endless amount of people who are like, I'm switching to Pathfinder. And it's been a lot of people that I've seen talking about that. Can't say I blame them. I'll be glad to have them. That being said, if you have only ever played 5th edition D&D, there's a handful of things that you might want to know that are different in Pathfinder. So bear with me while I talk about this stuff, Waples. Don't sit there and sigh the whole time.
I'm gonna.
No, I'd rather get some input from you.
All right.
So the biggest thing when it comes to characters that you need to know about Pathfinder over 5th edition is feats. The entire character is built around feats. You're going to have feats for your ancestry. You will have feats for your class. You will have feats for your background. Like there are a ton of feats, and that is how you develop your characters and make them different from every other character.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody who's trying to make a character for that game, just be aware. You're going to have a lot of feats. I think starting out at first level, you might have 5 or 6 feats.
So you're saying Pathfinder has the same problem with it that I thought that 4th edition had a problem with?
Yeah, I know you hated it. For me, it was the best damn thing about 3rd edition. I loved it.
Yeah, because when you have 3,000 feats that you have to read through by first level, it's too much.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
You expect a player to read through 1,000 feats and know which ones are applicable and which ones are not, ones are rubbish and which ones are great.
But hold on. You don't have to do that. Because there are hard restrictions on what feats you can and cannot get. So,
but it doesn't matter because the list is still going to be massively long. Yeah, oh, cool. Here are all the Dragonborn feats. You can't pick it if you're not a Dragonborn. But that's 30 of 3,000.
Oh, it might be like 5. It's not going to be that many. It's not a huge, huge amount. Then your first level. Well, here's your level 1 feats. These are the ones you can pick from.
So, how many level 1 feats are there?
I would have to look. It might vary. What's the book? I don't have it right.
When you're standard human, how many feats are at level 1?
This may take me a minute to find because I'm having to literally pull this stuff up. All right. Do you just want like race feats or ancestry?
No, at level 1, I'm making a human fighter.
All right, so fighter feats.
How many feats do I have to sort through to know how to play this class?
You know, it doesn't even matter, because I know if I tell you it's 8, you're going to hate it.
Eight's okay. If that's just 8 fighter feats, I guess.
Well, I'm just throwing out a number. All right, here, I'll just grab the cleric. Okay, cleric feats, because that's the first one I hit. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There are 6 first level feats for a cleric.
Okay, and you pick one, right?
Yeah. Well, I would have to read through the cleric, but probably one. Yes.
So, and there's also racial feats as well, too, right?
Yeah, and they're going to be roughly the same amount.
Okay, so another, what was the number you gave me?
6.
8. So we're talking 16 feats.
Yeah, and then you'll have your background stuff, which will be, I think, 5, give or take. It's less. It's not as many.
All right, so now we're at over 20 feats at first level.
Yeah.
And I get to choose one.
Well, one of each of those, yes. And this is just off the top of my head. This is not necessarily correct. I would have to literally parse through this whole thing to figure it out.
Okay. In fourth edition, when you had to pick a feat, okay, I think you chose 2 feats per level or some shit like that. At first level, there's literally thousands of feats that you had to sort through.
Yeah, because they probably
20 is not terrible.
They probably in 4th edition, because they saw how popular it was in 3rd edition, they just fucking ran with it, and they didn't put level restrictions on it. They probably just said...
No, there were level restrictions.
Okay, well, they said, these are your prerequisites, and then at that point, you have to dive through all the prerequisites and shit. Now, if you start adding in other books, yeah, there's going to be more stuff.
Yeah, it was too much to manage. Now, 20-ish... divided by 3, and you have to choose 3, isn't terrible, but you still run into the issue that one of them is always going to be better than all the rest.
That's
going
to happen no matter what.
No matter what, right. So what's the point in making someone choose every single level a bunch of feats that they have to know which ones are the better ones to choose?
Because there are a lot of players just like me who don't care what the better one is.
That's bullshit.
No, it isn't.
You are not going to sit there and pick a bullshit shitty feat just to pick a bullshit shitty feat.
I do it constantly.
Do you choose weapon mastery for D&D? Any of your characters ever?
Let's see. When I played a barbarian who should have had like weapon skills over everything, I picked skilled as my 4th level feat.
That skilled is a great feat though.
Yeah, but it's not the best one.
I didn't say you always pick the best, but you're not going to pick a shitty one.
Look, there are going to be some shit feats. You know, generally, I'm not going to pick the shittiest feat. Very, very few people are going to pick the shittiest feats. But that it doesn't mean you're always going to pick the best feat.
Right, but you pick skilled, which is one of the best feats.
But I'm a barbarian. I should have picked great weapon master or something else of that nature. I took skilled.
Not if you're like a totem barbarian or anything like that.
I wasn't.
You could be dual wielding. You don't have to be a two-handed barbarian.
Anyone who's not doing a two-handed barbarian is not using the best choice.
No.
Yes.
Depends on what kind of barbarian you're building.
So
totem barbarians will never use anything but a sword and shield.
Well, I was not. I was the Tempest, I think it was.
The dragon, the beast shape-shifting ones don't use two-handers. They don't use a weapon.
Well, they're doing it wrong.
I mean, their class is built around not using a weapon. How are they doing it wrong?
Don't play that class. It's not the best one.
No, it's one of the better ones.
So anyway, but just realize if you get into Pathfinder, you're going to have to pick feats, lots of feats. That's how you build your characters. Let's see. The biggest change, I think, between it and other editions of any D&D style things is the 3 actions. In D&D, you get a move action, you get a bonus action if you have access to that, and you get a standard, or what do they call it, just action.
Mm-hmm.
So in this one, you just get 3 actions. You can use it however the hell you want. It could be for movement, it could be for 3 attacks, it could be for casting 3 spells if they are just singular action spells.
Yeah. I mean, that just comes down to preference. A lot of people like the Pathfinder actions better than the move action minor-ish thing ways of the D&D 4 or 5e systems. And that's fine. And that's just neither here nor there. There are benefits and positives to each of them.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter at the end of the day, because you still just, you have to remember more intricacies with the Pathfinder system. Like, this costs two actions and this one doesn't. Yes. You know. Yeah,
but they are actually very, you're not wrong. You do have to kind of remember that with all of the different things you can do in there, they put a little symbol. So it's pretty easy to spot how many actions things take.
Yeah, which, again, it's not that bad, but it's just, it's not as simple.
No. Pathfinder is not as simple of a system as 5th edition D&D. By any means. 5th edition D&D is probably the easiest goddamn gaming system in the world. It's very simple.
And until this year, the number one.
Yeah. Yep. Let's see. Crits. Crits work a little differently. So there's crit success, standard success, fail, and crit fail.
I'm never playing the system.
Let me finish.
I am not going to crit and then fail to crit. Fuck that.
No, you're just making shit up. You didn't even hear. You're not even.
You're right. I did. I jumped to conclusions.
Yes, you did.
On my jump to conclusions, man.
Every time you roll the die, there are one of four things that can happen. You could have a critical success, a standard success, a failure, or a critical failure. Now, do you understand? You follow?
So the exact same thing D&D has.
You
just put more words when there were none were needed.
D&D does not have critical failures, and D&D does not.
D&D absolutely has critical failures. What fucking game are you playing?
No, it doesn't. What happens? Yes, what happens if you roll a natural one on a skill check?
You critically, you don't on a skill check. Nothing. You add your modifier and whatever. What
happens if you roll a nat one on a attack roll?
You critically fail.
You miss.
You critically fail.
You can call it what you want, but it's literally you miss. Well, guess what? In Pathfinder, if you roll a nat one on a attack roll, it's the same thing. You just miss. Because there are no real crit fails on standard attack rolls in Pathfinder. The difference in attacks doesn't really seem to change. If you hit a crit success, you just dealt double damage. It's when you start rolling skill checks and saving throws and certain spells, that's when things have critical successes and critical failures. So the basic idea in when it comes to damage spells, we'll just use that as an example because that's the easiest one. I throw a fireball at something. The one guy rolls a critical success against it. He does not take any damage. Whereas the poor bastard who crit fails, he takes double damage.
So instead of punishing the martial classes, they're punishing the casters instead for casting spells.
I don't see it as a punishment. If somebody fails against other spells, like there, a lot of the spells in the handbook will have specific things that happen if you critically succeed or critically fail that skill check or that saving throw. Sorry.
How is it not punishing the spellcaster with they now take double damage from the spell if they fail?
If I throw a fireball and they critically fail and they take double damage, how is that punishing?
No, you said that when they cast the spell and then they fail to cast the spell correctly, they take double that damage.
You misunderstood me again.
Uh-huh.
If I cast a fireball and there are two people in that fireball, okay, I'm the player. Boom, fireball. There's two guys in it. One of them, boom, he rolls a nat 20, crit success. He does not take any damage from that fireball. But the other guy, he crit fails it, rolls a one, he will take double.
Okay, because you said that the
person that is passing that the is spell. What I said. You just misunderstood me.
Okay. So
anyway, but just realize there's effectively four levels of success in Pathfinder. Second edition, at least. First edition does not have that. They've changed how skills, not how they work, but how you calculate them. They've simplified it a little bit. Excuse me. So there are effectively five ranks of skills. There's untrained, trained, expert, master, and legendary. And when you create your character, you'll probably be trained in a handful of skills. So say you're playing a fighter, you're going to be trained in athletics. You're going to be trained in intimidation. And then you'll have options to pick up a few others here and there. Train just means you have a +2 to that role. You will also add in your level to the role, which I don't necessarily like, but that's how they did it. So numbers in the game tend to be a little bigger because you're adding your level to all of your fucking skills. But so trained is +2, expert +4, master +6, legendary +8. As you go up in levels, you'll start getting it. It'll say you become, say you're 15th level at that fighter. It might say you are now you're now legendarily proficient in athletics. So you just have +8 to the roll. Make sense?
Yeah.
These are things that people have to know. I didn't say they were necessarily the best thing, but these
are. No, it just sounds like they took 5e and made it more complicated.
Well, I'm perfectly fucking okay with that since 5e is so stupidly simple.
I mean, if it serves a purpose that makes the games run better, great.
It runs fucking smooth. It runs exactly the same as far as that goes. It's not complicated.
Everyone that said that, oh yeah, Pathfinder was just 2E was just them updating the rules and make it play like 5th edition. That's honestly what it sounds like.
The only thing
it's that 5th edition with extra steps.
The only thing I've seen that's really kind of 5th edition related was the three actions thing. Everything else is literally just kind of carryovers from 3rd or something new, like the crits.
I mean, a lot of 5th is carryovers from 3rd, too.
Right,
so.
Yeah.
I mean, skill adding different tiers of skill checks is just adding more words to what a skill check is.
Yeah. Now,
that's anti the whole purpose of tech writing. Tech writing is, you don't want to make things extra wordy and super long and overcomplicated. You want to be as simple and concise as possible your point across.
Some people are, I'm bad at wording shit. It's not necessarily worded bad in the writing.
Not to say it's worded bad, it's just, it's overly worded. Like you said, just for the skill checks, having 4 different levels or 5 different levels of skill checks when you could just have a skill check and add numbers to it. But no, you're adding tiers to something that didn't need a tier thing to begin with. The action economy stuff of Pathfinder versus 5e is different. And I would say that the Pathfinder one makes more sense. And the 5th one is more simple. I think the Pathfinder one is more tactical, and the 5th edition one is just more simple, more approachable.
Yes.
And that's so far the only difference between the two systems has been that giving rolls 4 levels of success is just overcomplicating what a critical miss, critical fail, and a normal success is. It's like the whole bullshit they're trying with Dean Dunn with the D20 test system. You're taking a simple concept and you're adding too many words to just roll a D20.
I personally love the crit success, crit fail thing. I had talked about it on a podcast a while back about adding in crit success, crit failures to spells. I don't remember which podcast it was. It was one of them. I liked the idea of it, and I'm glad to actually see that somebody has implemented it. And to be fair, this was out before I ever talked about it. I just hadn't heard about it.
Yeah, but that's also been homebrewed 1,000 times over,
Look, everything's been homebrewed 1,000 times over. These were probably pulled from homebrews.
Saving throws on spells don't have a critical hit or critical miss component because you take half damage if you succeed.
That was specifically to the damage spells that I was talking about. So let me kind of point out the reasoning that why they did this. So a lot of spells in Pathfinder will still have an effect even with a success on a save. So bear with me here because I'm pulling this out of my ass. I don't have any spells in front of me. So say I cast a hold person spell or some shit on somebody and they hit that success, they might still have some sort of a negative to themselves for a round. You know, maybe I should probably just pull out a fucking spell. Otherwise, I'm just going to butcher the shit out of this. Okay, so here's a perfect example. All right, I got Gust of Wind. So if I target somebody with Gust of Wind, it's normally going to try to push them back, knock them over, etc. It should knock them prone. So if they succeed, the creature still can't move against the wind. So they can't move forward against it. A crit success, they're completely unaffected by it. A failure, they are knocked prone. A critical failure, the creature is pushed 30 feet in the wind's direction, knocked prone, and takes bludgeoning damage.
Okay.
So even with successes, there are still some very minor negatives to some of the spells. Not all of them, but some of them. Okay. Yes, it is more complicated. It is complicating things, which I know you hate, but it adds more detail. It adds things that a lot of people want to see.
Well, no, people just don't want their spells to fail and have no effect. And I can understand that, you know. It sucks when you cast whole person, waste your entire spell slot and action, and nothing happens. You know,
it's terrible.
It's cool that stuff happens, but now you're also upscaling the power level of spells so that everything always has some kind of effect. So now you got to balance all of their players and all of the hit points and all of the resistances they have against the fact that something is always going to be happening. So it slowly starts creeping up that power scale more and more and more, which is fine, which is okay. But eventually you're playing Dragon Ball. But
I mean, really, to be fair, Pathfinder has 10th level spells, so you are playing Dragon Ball,
right? So, it sucks that whole person fails, but it's easier for people to understand that when a spell fails, nothing happens, or half damage if it's a damage spell, and having to remember the intricacies of spells. Especially someone like me who's just shit at spells.
As the DM, it is not your job to know every spell in the game. That the player who's casting it should have it pulled up in front of them, and they should know the effects.
Yeah.
If you as a DM are casting a spell, you should have the spell pulled up in front of you. You should know the effects.
Yeah. Speaking of spells, by the way, I promised my players will talk about this, and it seems like a good point to do it. He keeps hearing that sleep is one of the best spells at early levels.
At first level.
But he cannot for the life of him get sleep to work under any circumstances. And so I want to kind of just go over a few of the times he's used sleep. And
well, I still had one more thing to go over on the Pathfinder.
We'll come back to it. We'll come back.
Okay.
To it.
All right. Cool.
So how do you know what sleep is? You basically
how it works. Yep.
20 foot radius. And when it explodes, you roll a set number of D8s. I believe the first level spell is what? 68.
I would have to look up the exact numbers. Let me pull it up.
I bet you can pull it up faster than you can.
You probably already have it pulled up.
I do. It's 5D8. Okay. And it goes up an additional 2d8 for every slot above the first. Now, so when do you cast sleep? Under what conditions do you cast sleep?
I, as a spellcaster, never cast sleep.
Under what conditions would you most probably cast the sleep spell?
If I am first level and there are a buttload of kobolds, I will cast sleep, as long as they are not standing next to my party members.
So, any other times when you would cast sleep?
Definitely not against elves.
Okay.
No, it's a spell that you use at first or second level. You cast it against large groups of small enemies with very few hit points.
Yeah. Small enemies, large hit points, and you pray low hit points, and you pray that someone they get put to sleep. You shoot for at least one or two.
Yeah, hopefully you get maybe two if you're really lucky. Three if you're ungodly lucky.
Okay. So I believe at one point in time he cast sleep, and it did put a bunch of people to sleep. Okay. I think they were cultists, and a bunch of them were bloodied. So a bunch of them fell asleep, and they just mopped up the floor with them.
Yeah, perfect.
But in the past couple of games, he's used sleep now 3 times, and they have all failed spectacularly. The first time he used it was when he tried to put to sleep an elven guard. Yep. Now, I did say it was an elf, but they were kind of a distance away. They would know that it was taller. I would have given the passive perception to check that it was an elf because, you know, they're taller and skinnier and pointy ears and all that. It would have been too hard to see, but it was nighttime, so maybe he didn't want to metagame. I know he did say in the game chat that he panicked and he cast sleep on the elf, and it didn't work. Okay. There was a bloodied werebear criminal that came walking into to one of the player's shops. He's a pharmacist, or he's a doctor, and the guy was severely wounded.
Yeah.
I rolled a random percentage of his health that the guy would have remaining. I rolled a 33. That's what I was going to put it to anyways, but I said, hey, I'll leave the chance. And I rolled a 33. Mm-hmm. But even at, I think he cast it at second level too. Even at the number he rolled, he got like 38.
Yeah.
Even at like the 30% hit points that the werebear has, he's still just above that amount. So he didn't get put to sleep. And then they were breaking into a villa. It was a houndmaster and his 2 dogs. The 2 dogs weren't dogs.
What were they?
I don't want to say because the players don't know.
Okay, all right.
Well, they weren't dogs. But they did have hit points equivalent of dogs. He cast sleep, and he specifically said that he didn't want to get the dogs into sleep. He just wanted to get the human. Mostly because they were told not to kill any civilians of Waterdeep while they raid this villa.
Okay.
So, if he had caught the dogs in there, these monsters, whatever they would be, the not dogs, would have been put to sleep in a spell. But since he just made sure just the human got hit by it, the human had more hit points than the sleep did.
Yep.
Now, I've seen some variants of the spell where people like take out a pseudo amount of hit points from the player. So like once they lose, let's say the monster has 50 hit points and I cast sleep and I hit 35, they have 15 hit points remaining for the rest of the combat. When they take 15 points of damage, they fall asleep. Just to help balance sleep a little bit more and make it feel like you're not shitty. And
I think that's probably too powerful, but it's an attempt to fix it.
Yeah. It kind of is too powerful. I mean, I'm not going to change it. I'm just leave it as it is. But it still does work on, let's say, and here's some hints, a mob of town folk.
Yeah.
That are trying to chase after you. Sleep works great on them.
Yep. The part of the problem with sleep is, especially in 5th edition, most monsters are literally just sacks of hit points.
Yeah, they really are.
Because that's the design of 5th edition. So, and they have upped the amount of sleep, like the dice roll for 5th edition from what they had in 3rd edition. I don't know what it was at 4th. But even then, it's still just not enough to get most things.
Definitely not a single target monster. Like even goblins. You have a group of goblins. They have...
Ten apiece, I think.
Ooh. I just want the goblin monster, damn it. A goblin boss has 21. And a goblin by itself has 7. So a group of goblins would definitely put a couple to sleep.
Yeah. So if you throw that at a group of goblins and a goblin boss, you're absolutely not getting the boss with it. You might get a few goblins, 2 or 3, but that is what it's used for.
Yeah. It never works on single target monsters. And I felt bad for the player because he's trying his best. Like he used it against the bloodied werebear, and like that was a perfect shot. It just he didn't roll high enough.
Yeah.
And you know, he still had some hit points.
Yeah, you read it and it sounds like it's an awesome spell. Oh, it'll
really
put to sleep 5d8 hit points worth of creatures, starting with the lowest one moving to the highest, you would think that you would be able to get some decent sized monsters with that, but it just never works out that way.
Yeah, I really kind of wish like it would just was 40 hit points, because it'd be, I don't think rolling the number for sleep is that important, and that way you know the break points of like what sleep will do, because but then I know everything has to be rolled, but it's just, it never works on a single target.
Nope. And that's why,
unless
I don't,
it's a player,
that's why I don't ever use the spell. It's just not worth it. Anyway,
not when you can fireball.
Yeah. I mean, there's just better stuff at first level, like magic missile. Magic missile's just here. You're taking some damage. Enjoy.
All right. So what's the last Pathfinder thing I'm going to hate?
Yeah, you'll hate it, I have no doubt. For people who have played 3rd edition, they'll love it. So 3rd edition, it was always a problem with the amount of modifiers in combat. You know, you get a +1 morale bonus, and a +1 this bonus, and a +2 this bonus, and by the time you've added up 15 bonuses that you're getting for all this bullshit, you know, you finally got your attack roll number. And I hated that. Everyone hated that in 3rd edition. It was just too many modifiers. So they've definitely narrowed it down as to what modifiers you can get. So there's 4 types. There's circumstance, status, item, and untyped. And these will make perfect sense when I actually explain them. So circumstance bonus is a circumstance. You're flanking. You get a +2 to hit or whatever it is. Status bonus, somebody casts bless on you. There's your +1 bonus. Item, you're using a +2 sword. +2 bonus. Untyped, these are incredibly, incredibly rare, to the point that I couldn't even find one. But you know, there might be something that comes up that's not a specific type. You do not stack any of these bonuses. So if you have multiple circumstance bonuses, oh, I'm on high ground and flanking, so it should be +4. No, you take whatever the highest one is, and that's what you get. I'm using a +2 magical bow with a +1 arrow. That's +3, right? Wrong. You have a +2 bow. That's what you get. So very, very much simplified as to what you're going to be dealing with. Most combats, if you've got magic items and are, you know, using flanking rules or circumstantial stuff, and somebody's casting spells, at most you're going to get 3 little bonuses that you'll have to stack. I know it's not as simple as, oh, I have advantage, disadvantage, but it allows more creativity, I think.
I was on board when you said that, oh, this is simplified, and it was totally not simplified. The only problem with that system, okay, like the idea of having a a status bonus, right?
Yeah, that's for people casting spells or using abilities,
so
to give
that's
you
your status bonus slot. Okay. You have your item bonus slot, it sounded like, right? Right.
Which everybody's, if you have magic items, you're going to be using that anyway, no matter what, even in 5th edition.
Okay. So you have your item bonus slot, you have your spell bonus slot, and then you have your, what you call it, the situational bonus slot?
The circumstance.
Circumstance. Yeah. And then the unknown one, okay?
Which almost never shows up.
So to understand that better, you can have a bonus in every one of those 4, right?
Yes, you could have, if all of them are in play at that moment, you could have 4 bonuses. Now, that being said, the item bonus should already be on your damn character sheet.
Right. So you could have possibly 4 bonuses to you. Now, the circumstance bonus, you said flanking was +1. Are there any other types that give a higher value?
I'm sure there are. I don't know the specifics of it. Circumstance, I was just using flanking as the example.
Okay. So you had me until there. Okay. So the static item bonuses is pretty much a staple of tabletop RPGs. You have a +2 sword, you know, cool. That's awesome. And that always applies. Okay. And other +1s from your dagger and other things don't count. We all know how the item bonuses work. The status bonus and the circumstantial bonus would be great if they had a static value assigned to that slot and it was either active or not active. So let's say the circumstantial bonus is always a +2, and the spell stat bonus is always a +4, or at certain levels it becomes +5 or 6, whatever, and it scales up. Or maybe it starts at 2 and scales up to 8 or something like that.
Now, dude, I just want to point out, with a status bonus, that is a thing in 5th edition. That already exists. And it's right, it's varying numbers. It's going to be less rare than it will be in Pathfinder.
It's rare. Bless is always forgotten, and most of them are just die rolls now.
I have never forgotten Bless, and every time you cast Shield, that's a modifier as well.
Right. So, those are usually on the player to remember. On cast reaction, that happens. The Bless is on the players to remember as well, too. For the DM to keep track of it, I don't have to keep track of it. Right. The players forget. The problem with, like, 4th edition was the same problem that I hated the most. It was that you had all these bonuses and they would stack up, and like you would get that the +7, +8.
Yeah.
And they would change every round.
Yep.
If they're static and they're like, these are the slots and these are the values that can be assigned to the slot, that's great. But I'm not going to spend 5 minutes going, okay, well, this circumstance bonus is +1, this one's +3, this one's +2.5 under condition that it's not bright outside. I don't want any of that dumb bullshit. So if it's just like circumstance bonus is always +2, status effects are scaling and
the circumstance easy bonus, to understand. The primary circumstance bonus you're going to run into in Pathfinder seems to be flanking. And I want to say it's a +2. Like, it's not some crazy number that's changing all the time. It's flanking.
You get right. But my issue is that there could be other circumstances that now you have to keep remembering everybody, the DM and the players, that's there. And that's annoying. Well, it's cool that flanking, I still use flanking. It's cool. Flanking's there, you have advantage, move on. Okay, the question is whether or not you have flanking or you don't have flanking. There's no other circumstances that can happen to, you know, give you advantage or disadvantage. That always comes from the player side via abilities and skills. So, like I said, I'd have to play it and kind of get used to it, but I just don't want to have a number of different values that I have to basically figure out every round.
Yeah, and that is your, you know, that seems to be what you prefer as a DM. As a DM, I don't like a massive amount of modifiers. Third edition was a lot. It was too much.
I mean, but you have four you just mentioned. One of them was on the players to remember. The other three are on the DM. That sucks.
Not necessarily. So if I as the DM am casting the spell, then it's on me to remember the status bonus. If the players are casting the spell, that's on the players for the status bonus. The circumstance bonus, we're all going to be paying attention to that because, like I said, it's primarily going to be flanking. The untyped bonus, if I ever figure out what the hell they're even talking about with that, I'll let you know. But I watched a video about it, and they're like, it's very rare, and I couldn't find any examples of it.
Yeah.
And the item bonus is on your character sheet. So there's literally, most situations, there'll be one modifier for me to pay attention to.
All this did is give me another bullet for people that say, I don't like 4th edition because there's a lot of math involved. And then I can go, well, fuck you. The same thing happens in Pathfinder 2, and everyone loves that system. So
I never played 4th edition enough to know why I didn't like
it. It had a very similar system, status bonus system to Pathfinder 2.
Yeah.
But it happened even worse.
Now,
and
I
so
love,
like, you were having like 2 or 3 pluses and 2 or 3 minuses apply to every single attack roll every single time beyond static things like weapons and shit.
Yeah. I played a lot of third edition as a DM. It was kind of a fucking nuisance. So this I will be quite happy with. But I still prefer this over advantage, disadvantage. Not to say there's anything wrong with advantage, disadvantage, but one of my complaints was that there weren't any modifiers in 5th edition with rare exceptions.
But that's fine. That's what advantage, disadvantage is for, is to make it simple and easy.
Perfectly okay with it. Yeah, but I want a little bit of numbers. Just a little. Give me a +2 here and there. That's all I ask. It wasn't hard.
Don't add pluses. That's the worst fucking thing ever.
See, and that's just it's
adding more math to a game that's already math heavy is dumb.
How is that math heavy? 5th edition is not math
heavy. Because I sat around the table with people who can't add 2 to 25.
You need better players.
It is slow and dumb, and it is horrible. It's simple numbers. We all should get it. But people are always going to struggle. People are always going to stumble. If you add up the dies, if you want status things, say it have advantage, disadvantage, start adding in just like straight D4 or D6 modifiers to rolls. You know, if you want the variation to add up a little bit more instead of rolling 2D20s and taking the highest. Because then you have that little bit of extra oomph here and there. And that's basically what Bardic Inspiration and all them are, as an extra D4 or D6 here or there.
I'm perfectly good with those two, but then Bless should also give a little bonus. And yeah.
No, if you have too much of that dumb stuff, people are going to forget. I can't tell you how many times people forget to use Bless when it's their turn.
Well, conveniently enough, I don't have to worry about stacking any of that shit with this. So.
Yes, you do. You just talked about the system where you have to stack all that stuff.
No, there's very little of it that has to be stacked. I only have to stack a circumstance and a status, really. And that's if, and I don't have to worry about it if the players are doing it. That's on them.
But this is still going to run into the problem that the players are going to forget.
Well, if they forget, they forget. That's always been an issue. It's, hell, go back to first edition and people forget shit. That's just the way it is, man. That's how
I know, but you're saying the system is great because, you know, it adds bonuses and stuff, but
I like still having a little bit of modifiers, just a little crunchiness. I don't want to have a butt ton of them to stack because that it does become overwhelming.
You have four.
Yeah, that's once again, most of this is not.
No, you have four that have their own category of stuff.
Yes. Of which.
So it could be anything, like only one of them is static. Only one of them is ever going to be the same.
Yeah.
So now you have to sort through which status ones are we using right now.
No. What I'm talking about is, okay, I got one status. I don't have four spells. Well, this one gives me a +1. This gives a +2. That's a +1. I don't have any of that shit. Because it's one spell will give me a bonus.
And yeah, but you still don't know which one is the better bonus. What happens if you have one that gets +3 and one gets +2?
Well, the +3.
You take the +3, right?
Yes, you take the better of them.
So now you're rolling a d20, +3, +2, +2. Oh, I'm flanking +1. And you got to remember all that shit. And that was the problem with 4th edition combat, is you had like +10-ish in modifiers that you had to remember every single time that were not written down anywhere, not on paper, not auto-calculated anywhere. And people always would forget different things. People forget Bless right now, and that's just one thing.
I don't know how people forget Bless, but
they forget it all the time.
Once again, I think you need better players.
Again, maybe you need to play with more players and understand that it's your little group of people who are really good at the game isn't the vast majority of people playing the game. Half of them can't remember what advantage and disadvantage is half the time. So you want a more complicated system for people who can't get advantage, disadvantage the easiest way.
Yeah, I like having, I don't know, maybe I am spoiled. Maybe I do play kind of with the cream of the crop.
No, you're extremely spoiled.
I'm perfectly okay with that. That's why we have so many gaming systems out there. You can play the D&D. D&D is a beginner's game. 5th edition kind of is. It is intended to be easy. And I like that it is. That being said, I will move on. I'm going to other ones that are not. I've played 5th edition for way too long at this point.
And that's also why when we talk about D and Dun, the D20 test thing that they were trying to add in, they just overcomplicated just a D20 roll. And it's just, that stuff's not needed. You don't need that level of stuff to have fun just around the game.
I mean, if you really, truthfully, you don't need any of that to have fun. If you want to go to the simplest system, 2nd edition was so goddamn easy. The only thing that's complicated in that was Thaco. And if you can get around Thaco, the simplicity of that game is immense. There are no rules for what you have. How many actions do you have a turn? Well, it'll tell you how many attacks you have. Most of the time, you're getting one attack around. You know, you're going to roll an attack roll, you're going to roll a damage roll, and that is your turn. It's very simple. There's no, you know, there are no movement, bonus action, swift action, free action. There's none of that shit. That stuff didn't exist in the early editions.
What about my ambidextrous action?
There is ambidexterity. It is a thing that you, if you are a ranger and a ranger only, you can wield two weapons.
That's an insult to everyone that's ambidextrous and not a ranger.
So, that's what I'm saying. Yeah,
you know, I know more chefs that are ambidextrous than rangers. Gordon Ramsay's ambidextrous. He's a soccer player. What the hell?
We know some park rangers. That counts, right?
So, one last thing. So I know we're running a little bit long.
Yeah, well, we've been going on about this for a bit. So we're gonna be talking Pathfinder some in the future and D&D some in the future.
So the last thing I saw is they're talking about trademark and about this, almost about the OGL thing and how,
back to this.
Listen, so it's just a fascinating piece of like lore. So when they're talking about like the OGL, especially for the old editions, okay, the OGL kind of applied to them, but it didn't in a lot of ways as well too. Because in order to play like first and second, they said you needed a lot of charts and whatnot to play them, right?
Not really.
You need that Thaco chart. You need to know what it is. You need that spreadsheet graph, right?
No, but you did. Having a Thaco chart was useful.
Yeah. So the Thaco charts and all the other charts and systems designed by Gary Gygax and his crew for first and second edition, you can't ever reuse or republish ever in any system. Even if you create something else that's similar to Thaco and have that same table, you can't use that because the tables and spreadsheets that they created for those editions, all right, are trademarked, not copyrighted, trademarked, okay, as pieces of art and artistry. So if you use something similar to that, you are infringing upon the art of the first and second edition because of those spreadsheet tables.
I wonder how that's that why.
I don't know, but it was just this weird piece of lore that came out about that. It's just like, that's fascinating how the Thaco chart that Gary Gygax did is considered a picture of a spreadsheet.
I would like to see the Thaco chart they're talking about specifically. There is it wasn't a printout, but it was basically a cutout one that came out of one of the magazines or books. I actually have it here where it's like a wheel that you can rotate around. That might be kind of what they're talking about.
Yeah.
That's kind of fascinating, though.
Yeah, it really is. It's like, so that's why like, there's never really been first, second edition stuff ever redone or rewritten. Because when you start getting into it, there's a lot of really weird gray legal area. And that was part of the reason they created the OGL in the first place. It was to kind of like rein all of that in.
Yeah.
And the first, second edition stuff is all trademarked instead of as an open gaming license. So I thought that was interesting.
On another piece of lore before we get out of here, and this will be real quick. Did you know that basically Gary Gygax / Dave Arneson created Knowles?
Did they?
I Googled this thing because I was very curious. Where did this come from? You know, because it sounds like something that you would have seen somewhere in mythology or folklore somewhere. No, apparently there just isn't anything. They created it.
Same thing with Mind Flayers.
Yeah, but Mind Flayers, we know they created because that's trademark. Beholders, that's, you know, it's not trademark, but it's, you know, you can't use it.
I guess they found the first printing of it, and it was some like 1960 article that one of them wrote, mm-hmm. well before D&D or Chainmail was even out. So
yeah,
it was kind of interesting how that kind of came to be, because there was a big discussion about whether or not the Mind Flayer is actually owned by WotC or if it was just some other mythology that they stole,
right?
Borrowed.
Yeah, and that might be why Knowles aren't like the Mind Flayer or the Beholders and stuff, because there are legends at least of hyena men from Africa.
Yeah.
And maybe that's where they got the concept from, but there's not really any proper lore out there on them. And they weren't Knowles. They were interesting thing that I found out about that. So.
Well, when I was a kid, I thought I made up the word flog.
Oh, you definitely didn't.
I did not, no.
No, pretty sure our parents did.
What?
Bye, Craig.
You got some issues, man.